Scott Hartley was a researcher and went on to work with product and operations at companies like Facebook and Google. But the most well-known part of Scott's journey began when he hit Sand Hill Road. Scott went on to become a co-founder of Two Culture Capital and Everywhere Ventures. Across these two VC firms, he invested in over 300 startups around the world, Latitude and LATAM included. In a world now ruled by AI, Scott talks instead about IA, or intellectual amplification. On a similar note, he's also the author of The Fuzzy and The Techie, Why the Liberal Arts Will Rule the Digital World. In this chat, Scott and I talk about what makes him confident about investing early on and in multiple countries, the difference between fuzzy and techie entrepreneurs, and the advice Scott shares most often with startup founders. My name is Brian Reckworth, and this is Latitude Podcast. Vamos Latam. First of all, we both had the experience of writing a book. We both got some background here in tech. You took a kind of a different career path than I did. Decade plus experience as a global venture capital investor. But before that, you worked at bigger companies like Google and Facebook. And you also were a researcher at some pretty prestigious institutions like Stanford, Harvard. Tell me how you got into the venture capital game. Was that just by virtue of being around these tech companies? What led you to that?
It's a good question. I had the fortune of growing up in Palo Alto, so not too far from Sebastopol, just down the bay. You know, and at the time, I joked that it was sort of a small town full of dentists and good weather and lots of Stanford professors. You know, but the backdrop really was always the internet. And so I sort of saw the boom and the bust of the dot-com world. You know, my first job as a sophomore, junior in high school was actually as an HTML editor for a text-to-mobile phone company that was based in Los Altos that went out of business, but the founder had already taken like two companies public at that point. And so just kind of seeing the rise and the fall and, you know, our early internet days, I think kind of planted the seed of tech. And then I really went on my own journey. And so my journey was always kind of rooted in wanting to experience the world. And I think get around the world and travel, focus on kind of economic development. And so I studied political theory. I did internships at the State Department and the UN. I went to the White House right after college. So I did a lot of things kind of going more toward the policy route. But really, I think what I was looking to do was just have a global life and global impact. And I tried that through a couple of different modalities. And so the first modality that kind of made sense was, okay, diplomacy seems like the most international thing to do. If you want to do international, you know, go work in foreign service or diplomacy. But then I found that to be very kind of slow paced and sclerotic. And then I went to DC and the White House experience was, you're kind of at the pinnacle of the ability to push policy, but then it's you got to deal with politics and all the other things that come with Washington. And so I think I experimented with a few different things, including kind of doing research at these large academic institutions. That was more like to pay the bills, you know, during college and just after. But tech was kind of this backdrop that I came back to, and probably because I had known about it as a kid. So my first job, you know, out of college was, post White House stuff was at Google. And, I was the annoying kid at Google that 3 months into the job, had written a 5-page white paper, you know, on why I should go to India to launch this team. And, you know, kind of ended up pushing this envelope of always trying to get abroad and get into these emerging markets. And so I went to India for a year with Google, and that kind of set me on this path, into more kind of global experiences, tech as a background, and then venture. I think we all kind of fall our way into venture in different ways, you know, whether it's from entrepreneurship. For me, it was kind of right place, right time. Probably having worked at two big brand name firms, being Google and Facebook, around 2010, 2011. And at that point, you know, there weren't a lot of people spinning out of those companies. They were still sort of on the rise. And it probably means I left too early in a lot of ways. So I have the counterfactual, maybe what my life would be if I had stayed at those companies. But I really loved the ability to sort of dial in, roll up my sleeves, work with entrepreneurs, and be able to do all these things at the same time. You know, as you know, on venture, you're not just investing, you know, you're building a company, you're building a team, you're working with your founders, you know, kind of helping your portfolio. You're also able to write. You're also able to do a number of other things that kind of all fall within this bucket of being an investor. And so for me, that was a really rewarding place that I kind of got to in 2011. And then I've just never really left the venture side over the last 12 years.
I don't think you have any regrets, and I don't think you should. I think you left at the right time and you embarked on a journey. One quick question. Did you work with Antoine Colasso at Google in India?
So Antoine, he was in India. I think he was there. I don't know if he was there just a bit after me, but we crossed paths at Google for sure. And then obviously he went to Valor and ultimately made a small investment in Taboom, you know, a few years back. So the world is, one thing I've learned over the years is just how, you know, one of my friends, one of the most profound things he said to me, probably back in 2009, we were standing in front of a map in his house and he had all those pins in the map. And he said to me, he kind of put his arm on my shoulder and he's like, life is long. We're going to get to all those places. And it was a very kind of profound moment for me because everyone always says, you know, life is short. You got to prioritize. And he was almost like saying this contrarian thing, which is, you know, we can go do anything we want out there and life is long and people come back around, things come back around. And so I think it was just this notion that you plant all these seeds and certain things grow, certain things don't, but people come back around in your life over and over again. And so, you know, Antoine's an interesting example of somebody that probably lightly crossed paths in India, but within our portfolio, we have a number of people, an investment portfolio where we've known those people for 15 or 20 years. And it's amazing to see the third company that they're building or, you know, even our relationship over the past, you know, 5 years, I'd say, the many different capacities that we've kind of intersected, whether it was you writing your book, us sort of thinking about how to scale communities globally across the world, you know, investing in Latitude. There's just so many different touch points. And, you know, it makes me excited for where our lives are going to be in 5 or 10 or 20 years and people kind of coming back around in different capacities.
I love the anecdote of the map and kind of I can visualize that. I find it interesting because you were born and raised in the epicenter of technology investing, yet everything you're describing is this global nature. So I just wanted to get, let's do a little kind of psychoanalysis here. What is the draw? And given that you have everything in your backyard, is it just that you find that there's an opportunity to kind of explore? What's the motivation now? Because whether it's Two Culture Capital or Everywhere Ventures, I mean, literally Everywhere Ventures, it describes the opposite of just Silicon Valley and Palo Alto. So talk me through that a little bit.
The joke used to be on Sand Hill that the clocks were set to Menlo Park, Palo Alto, and Redwood City. You know, and so you, instead of having the global clocks where it's, you know, GMT in London and New York and Singapore, it's the myopic sort of focus was on everything in your backyard. And so when I joined, when I went to Sand Hill in 2011, very quickly, I helped our team make an investment in China. We invested in one of the early accelerators in China that was trying to become the Y Combinator of China. And there really wasn't anyone on Sand Hill except for a couple firms that were even considering investing outside the US. And I think I've always kind of been drawn to just asking the questions of why not and sort of prodding on. I think it's probably a very contrarian nature of my being that probably lends itself well to venture capital because you're always sort of pushing back on the status quo and asking what's just beyond the frontier of something that seems radical or seems unthinkable that actually is contrarian and maybe right. And that's, you know, the mark of a good investment. And so things that are consensus have never really interested me. And I think it's just maybe something I've always kind of grown up around is kind of pushing back on what everyone else sort of believes or thinks and trying to poke holes in it a bit. So I think in the early days, it was both just interest in global. And I think from a psychological standpoint, from a personal standpoint, part of that was growing up in a place that was very cookie cutter and amazing, but also a little bit boring. And also hearing the stories that were from my father and his childhood had been across the world. You know, my grandfather was in World War II and then post World War II was on this journey of kind of international finance. And that brought my father's family to Saudi Arabia in the 1950s. So my aunt went to school in Beirut. My dad sort of grew up going to Baghdad and Damascus and Jerusalem and all these interesting places. And then had lived in Cuba and also in Bermuda. So our family photos, our family things around the house were all these global treasures that kind of his family had picked up over the years. And so I think that was the backdrop with sort of technology and with Palo Alto that for my sister and I, was always sort of kind of planting the seed of the other and this life that kind of we wanted to go seek out kind of beyond the shores of the US. And so, you know, I think the backdrop of all that, really Everywhere Ventures became probably the full expressed vision of all of these different experiences, you know, over the last decades, where the kind of contrarian nature was to push back on this idea that if you want to do global investing, everyone said, you have to be a growth investor. You know, if you want to go write checks around the world, you can only do that at Series F, you know, Series E, Series D, whatever it is. When the company has proven product market fit and tons of revenue, then you can go do global stuff. But you can't do pre-seed in a global capacity. That's impossible. That's what everyone sort of told us. And we really pushed back on that. And Jenny Fielding, my co-founder at Everywhere Ventures, you know, we both sort of said, no, we think we could build a different type of model that's community-driven venture capital that's rooted in founders around the world being our LPs. And a lot of the deal flow would come from that founder network. And we would actually be able to invest really early stage around the world through this founder network. And we could invest both very early and very globally. And everyone thinks that that can't be done, but we kind of beg to differ. And so it was this contrarian sort of bend that brought that to life. And I was really fortunate to find her and a partner that kind of believed the same thing. And I think that's one of the hardest things, you know, as we both know, founding different organizations, building your founding team, building that trust, kind of having a shared vision. Those are the things that really kind of make or break these sorts of organizations.
So what is the insight that allows you to feel confident in going into fill in the blank country and go early where, you know, maybe your network isn't super strong yet? How do you think about frontier investing?
Yeah, I think we get comfort probably two or three ways. I mean, one is obviously investing with a local partner. So if we're coming into LATAM, you know, the first people we call are you guys, right? So we call up Latitude and you guys are kind of our go-to. So I think local syndicate is kind of number one. So building a cohort of investors that really understand the local dynamics. But then the other two ways I think we kind of validate are around geographic. So from our LP base, folks that are either from the region or from the country know the market kind of deeply as well. And so quickly getting a pulse on what they think. And then the second layer is kind of sector, but sector I'd say is more global. And what's interesting about that is we're able to kind of see trends across these different geographies sometimes where we might have a company in India and a company in, you know, Brazil. And there actually are some big similarities between the two. And of course, there are many local differences, but we're able to kind of gain insights from certain sector leaders. So across the portfolio, for example, we might have 20 different companies that are across different vectors of insurtech, whether it's, you know, tools for agents or it's different underwriting models or it's different sort of ways to acquire and run MGAs. And we've seen these different models across, you know, five or six different geographies and four or five different business models. And so we have maybe 20 data points around just insurtech. And so we can very quickly sort of triangulate around a new business by pinging some of those founders that are either LPs of ours or portfolio companies of ours. And so when we talk about community-driven venture capital, it's not that we, you know, make decisions by consensus and we're a big angel network. We're actually kind of laser-focused two decision makers, but with a very deep network and kind of bench of expertise from across our portfolio and across our LPs of founders that we can kind of quickly get comfort. And so this morning, for example, you know, it's interesting because I'm talking to you prior to this, you know, I was talking to a team in Manila and a team in Cairo. And so having people on the ground sort of on all these different sides of the planet, it's very fun. It's very personally rewarding, but it's also interesting because we can quickly kind of zoom in on a region and get a few people to sort of comment. And that's really how we get comfort. Because, you know, as you know, at the early stage, we're making decisions primarily on, I'd say, team, market, and sort of directional bets. And so, you know, we tend to have to believe the direction of where the company is building, believe the market size is sufficiently large, and then really believe the team is gritty and authentic. And so I think the characteristics of team are, you know, is this person humble and a fast mover? Are they somebody that's going to launch and iterate like hell? Because nobody sort of, we're not looking for clairvoyance. We're not looking for market. Hey, we know exactly what's going to happen. What we're looking for is cadence. So I think cadence over clairvoyance is kind of one thing that kind of sticks with me. and humility to sort of be coachable and learn and going kind of directionally in the right way. And all those things kind of from a founder archetype, we believe those things and we believe the market's big enough. And we believe the direction is sort of makes sense. Then we try to validate with local sources. And then those are the things that we can get comfort around. And then obviously valuation kind of comes into play and what the specific mechanics of the deal are. But that's really how we kind of go from zero to making an investment.
It all makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you've got that local network and you've got the qualities that you can identify, a good founder anywhere has certain qualities. Like this, it's not like there's something in Manila that exists that doesn't exist in Brazil. It's like the kind of the cadence, as you mentioned, the speed, how quickly they learn, the kind of the persistence and the determination and how have they illustrated that they're just capable of digging in and grinding. These are all things that are like very identifiable in anywhere in the world.
It's interesting because I think people often ask, like, how's your investing strategy changed over the 10, 12 years you've been doing this? I think at the very beginning, like, you know, many people, I was drawn to the shiny objects of, oh, this person went to MIT. Oh, they worked at McKinsey. Oh, they did the right things. I now almost think of some of those things as yellow flags and negative signals. Not so much that they exist, but what I really test for beyond that is, has this person put themselves in places of adversity and taken risks before? And, you know, really we're looking for people with grit and perseverance, as you said. And so oftentimes we will test for that in interesting ways. So when we kind of verbally agree to make an investment, oftentimes that's when the clock starts, right? And when I say that, the clock starts because we're really looking at the reaction of the founder, how they then navigate the process. So sometimes we'll be building the syndicate with them. We'll be building the rest of the $1 million round because we're not the full check, right? So we're calling local partners. We're working with them. And the way they communicate, the way they run the process, the way that they're organized around running the process, the conversations of early conflict where we might push for pro rata rights and they say, oh, you're too small of a check and let me ask my lawyer. Those are the kind of conversations that defer to sort of looking for validation from somebody else rather than making a decision and addressing conflicts kind of head on. And so sometimes those are the early litmus tests where we actually will use those to say, you know, we did verbally commit to this. It's dragging on 3 months. It's been disorganized. You know, we're not quite sure that this founder is handling this, some of these things the right way. And, you know, we may dial down the position. We may sort of alter based on some of those things that we get to know a founder through that process. And so I think for anything, we're really looking for transparency and communication and organization and grittiness and authenticity and all those characteristics, like you said, that it doesn't matter if you're in Manila or you're in Cairo or you're in Sao Paulo. These are exactly the same characteristics across the world. And, you know, we're willing to kind of coach and try to teach people. And we just ask that they be, you know, receptive of that coaching and receptive to listen. And we think that together, you know, we can build great companies.
Talked about the kind of profile that you look for, you know, the qualities. Besides those descriptions you gave of the type of people you like, the grittiness, the authentic, what are some other signals that you value most when you make a decision to invest in a specific founder or startup?
I think it comes down to team, technology, market, and deal. Those are kind of the four big pieces. So, you know, at our stage, it's primarily team and market, I think, that determine the interest level in the company. And then, you know, valuation is also a gating factor. For us, you know, I think what we tend to do as far as a process is we've got three or four sectors that are main areas of focus. So whether it's, you know, fintech, health, or future of work. So those are the kind of first gating factors is, does it fit within our thesis? Does it fit within our valuation range? And then the second area is, you know, does this founder kind of seem to have the right characteristics? Is the market feel like it's a big enough market? And that gets us to maybe, right? So we go from a lot of no's to a pile of maybes. And then I think, you know, the way we make decisions is really on a relative basis. And so sometimes founders will come to us and say, what did I do wrong with my pitch? Or what was it about what I said that made you guys pass? And we say, look, it has absolutely nothing to do with you or the quality of your business. You guys could be exceptional. Right now, across the 20 companies we're talking to, we're making two investments. And it just so happens, based on personal passion or based on some other portfolio construction characteristics, we've decided to invest in these two companies and not these other 18 companies. And so I think for founders, it's really important to remember and recognize that you don't need every VC to like you. You just need a couple of us to love you and really want to dive all the way in. And I think that, you know, that's something that just keep at it and keep the numbers high. It's a numbers game, right? And you've got to build a pipeline just like a sales process. You've got to be very organized in how you assemble that pipeline and go through it. And what we always talk about is having sort of a crucible of maybe 6 or 8 firms that you're talking to at the same time. And the reason is because you create a lot of surround sounds where those firms start talking to each other. They start saying, hey, I talked to Brian and Gina. Have you heard of those guys? Yeah, Latitude. We talked to Brian and Gina too. And so you start to get this surround sound where people start to validate also within their networks. You know, those are important things. And if somebody says no, great, get them out of the funnel, add somebody else into the funnel, and just keep that crucible tight with 6 or 8 firms. And the reason we sort of suggest 6 or 8 is because if you're talking to 20 or 30 firms at the same time, it's too disparate, and you probably aren't getting that surround sound element. And if you're only talking to 1 or 2, it's not enough momentum that maybe to get people off the fence.
Yeah, I like the thought process around, you know, you just need a couple that are make the bet. And one thing I see sometimes founders trying to do is they try to like kind of please every investor, and you don't want to optimize for like reducing risk for the investor. You want to optimize for the big outcome potentially. So when you're trying to like, some founders that are inexperienced, they look at like trying to explain a story that's like, no, but this isn't that risky for you. If I'm an investor and I'm like, and someone says to me, hey, look, there's a chance this thing doesn't work, but if we get it right, this is going to happen. Like that is something that lights up an investor much more than trying to come with like some de-risk, particularly at the early stage of VC. You know, you've got these two firms. So you've got Two Culture Capital and then Everywhere Ventures, and Everywhere Ventures is earlier stage. And then Two Culture Capital is more stage agnostic. Is that right?
So Two Culture Capital, I'm no longer affiliated, but I started it a few years back with one of my best friends from college. And that was really a chance to, you know, my time on Sand Hill Road, I really realized that when you spot a great founder and you spot a great opportunity, no matter kind of what stage, you just want to be involved. And so I think this kind of stage agnostic notion was something that really resonated with me after kind of leaving Sand Hill Road and being sort of subject to the discipline, for better or worse, of, you know, ownership targets and very, very laser focused specific decision making. What I saw there was often missing great opportunities where maybe the ownership was at 13.9% and the ownership target was 15, and so we would pass on a deal. You know, and you look back and you say, gosh, if we could have gotten into Lyft and owned 13% of Lyft or whatnot, these would have been great investments. And so I think, you know, there's kind of a give and take to all these things, whether it's discipline keeps you alive on fundraising and on running a firm, but also you don't want to miss the major outliers, you know, because venture is all driven by power law returns, where one company in your portfolio might return the whole thing. So for me, you know, Two Culture Capital was kind of the early incarnation of just angel investing and writing checks with one of my good friends. That scaled into about 75 investments around the world across different stages. And then when Jenny and I started Everywhere Ventures, which was formerly known as The Fund, it was a small founder community in New York that then kind of blossomed into a series of founder communities around the world. And then about a year ago, we changed the name of the firm to kind of reflect the global nature of investing that we were already doing, and to kind of be more in line with that global sort of scope that we'd been doing. And so today, you know, basically we're focused on the pre-seed. And so we write $50,000 to $250,000 checks, primarily in sort of those early rounds that are, I'd say, $750,000 to about $2 million in size. Our average entry valuation is kind of in the range of a 6 to 8 million valuation, so typically under 10. And we focus mostly on the themes of future of money, future of health, and future of work. And so those tend to be sort of, you know, fintech kind of payment rails, maybe data plays within the health ecosystem or telemedicine, or future of work, the new evolution of SaaS, which I think is becoming kind of more vertical AI, globally agnostic across the world. So at this point, you know, we've invested all over LATAM. But in addition to that, you know, we've invested in Asia, in Europe, in Australia, in Africa. So truly everywhere.
It's definitely a global firm, and the name represents the actions well. Let me ask a question. We talked a little bit about this founder quality and,
you know, I know that you really focus a lot on the founder, and I want to dive into kind of a tangentially related topic around your book, because the book you wrote, you know, it's The Fuzzy and the Techie. And, you know, I want you to describe for the listeners that haven't read the book, you know, some of them may have read the book, but if you haven't read the book, could you give an idea more about what this kind of fuzzy and techie means? And how does that incorporate, how do you incorporate that into your investment process when you look at the profile of a founder?
Absolutely. And what's fun about Fuzzy and Techie is it's also Menos Techie Más Platón in Spanish. It's available in Spanish, and it's O Fuzzy e O Techie in Portuguese. Probably butchered that, but it's available in Sao Paulo. It's available, you know, across the world. And so the book really articulates what I saw as a trend early days on Sand Hill Road, where we had a lot of folks that were pitching us, and some of the best founders that we were maybe not investing in were people that came from industry that sort of had seen a problem firsthand and weren't necessarily the technical person building the company, but were the person that was kind of coming at it with soft skills and with the ability to sell and the ability to kind of communicate the vision and build the team around them. And so the initial sort of focus of the book was looking at this archetype of founder that wasn't sort of being represented well in the media. Everyone said, you know, if you've studied history or liberal arts or social sciences, you don't have a future. And I said, well, looking around Silicon Valley, actually some of the best investors, some of the best leaders at tech companies, some of the best entrepreneurs I knew were all people that had studied philosophy and studied history and studied literature. And so at Stanford University, there's terms that go back to the 70s that were called fuzzies and techies. And they were kind of these lighthearted terms of folks that had studied social sciences or the humanities and folks that had studied the sciences or, you know, computer science. And the false opposition between these two sides of campus and the fact that really, intellectual, amazing people, not to mention entrepreneurs, were really good and adept at putting together these two sides. So they were people that really could dive deep into a problem and analyze it as, you know, you might have to do in philosophy, where there's no right answer, but you got to dig in, grapple with ambiguity, get comfortable with gray area, debate, articulate things, write long form content. And somebody that could really sort of dig in on science and dig in on the other side. And so at Stanford, there was a major called Symbolic Systems. Symbolic Systems has produced, you know, some of the most innovative people I think that have ever come out of Silicon Valley. Scott Forstall, who created iOS, you know, Reid Hoffman, who founded LinkedIn, Marissa Mayer, who ran Google product and Yahoo, and a number of other people like Mike Krieger, who founded Instagram. And so kind of looking at this major Symbolic Systems and kind of decoupling what was it within that, you know, it was linguistics, it was philosophy, it was computer science, and it was in psychology. And so I thought, wow, these ingredients are really producing these incredible entrepreneurs. What is it about these ingredients? And so the backdrop of the book was kind of deconstructing this major at Stanford that had created all these amazing entrepreneurs, realizing that this debate had kind of been going on for 50 years of, Is it you know, philosophy worthwhile? Is English literature worthwhile? Or should everyone study biology and physics? And there was a lecture in 1959 debating this at Cambridge. And I realized, wow, these are the same debates that are happening over and over. But now we're debating them with humans and AI and code and context and data and privacy and these kind of two sides of the coin and debates. It's actually about both and about how to put those things together and all these great companies that have come out of people's ability to put these two sides together. So the book, you know, really kind of looks at these trends and then also AI and sort of the things that technology are taking away are the rote and routine skills that we might have. But what that really does is it levels us up as people, where we really need to dig in and double down on the human skills and the soft skills and the things that actually you learn from some of these majors in the humanities and in the social sciences. And so ironically, in this era of tech and AI, there's kind of this double flip back to people needing to be more human to actually compete and doubling down on the comparative skills that humans have in being collaborative and being communicative and being creative. And so all these things that actually you learn through a broad-based education in a place like a liberal arts school, where, you know, you're learning to code, you're learning technology, but you're not sort of throwing history and literature and philosophy and all these other things out the window. You're actually doing both. And so those are the themes of the book. And those are still things that we look for, you know, when we make investments, is a well-rounded founder that, you know, frankly, the only people who have ever really lost me money have been purely technical founders that have not had the ability to pivot, have not had the humility to hire a team, have not had the vision or the charismatic ability to sort of tell the story. And so I've personally experienced that the purely technical only founder doesn't work, and you really need both sides of the coin. And so one of the things we really push our founders to do is reflect on that and think about, how do we supplement the team? How do we have the fuzzy and the techie? How do we sort of storytell? And how do we, you know, win on both the technical product, but then also the story that will, you know, enable you to hire a team and sell the vision.
It's interesting because I see a lot of debate about this, and I've even seen this internally with our team a bit on like the technical founder versus the kind of, if you look at the historically, the most successful founders in Latin America so far have been more MBA types and consulting types rather than technical founders. There's an internal debate sometimes about that. I think we all know that you need to, in order to build a tech company, you need strong technical chops. Otherwise, it's not going to get built. And in my case, I struggled because my co-founder was a little bit more technical than I was, but not in the heavy engineering sense. And so we struggled, and that was probably part of our Achilles heel in building Viva Real, was that we didn't, and I promised myself I would, if I build another company, I'm going to have a really strong CTO from the very beginning. But do you think there's an overemphasis put on the technology piece? Or is that just like, you got to have it, but by itself, as you described, is like, is this the composition of the team? Do you find that some of the really strong technical people also have the skills, or is that kind of a unicorn in itself?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, technical folks have some of these skills, and that is something we look for. I think the way I think about it is technology is necessary but not sufficient, and so you have to have these other things in addition to technology, right? And I think certainly across different businesses, there is much more emphasis on technology or not. So in the case of core infrastructure, you know, let's say we're talking about Web3 infrastructure or payments infrastructure or whatnot, there's clearly a deeper technical component than a market dislocation or a marketplace where you say, I'm gonna assemble the pieces. So you know, one term that I love that kind of, I forget who coined it a few years back, but instead of full stack developer, you now have full stack integrators. And you think of the building blocks of integrating these different tools are becoming chunkier and bigger and more assembly ready. And so in many ways, you know, as an MBA founder, as the person that can spot a market dislocation or a business model that's working someplace that's not yet someplace else, you can sort of build the MVP and assemble the building blocks probably without, you know, crazy technical skills. But then I think to scale any company, you know, the complexities that start to come with any forms of scale require all sorts of technical expertise, you know, under the hood. So we tend to think of it as necessary but not sufficient. And so we really, if we have a deeply technical infrastructure type founder, you know, we might test for the humility around or the ability to hire and focus on storytelling, focus on some of these other things, because you just see, especially in this market, that being able to fundraise, being able to sort of manage burn and stay alive for long enough to let the market materialize around you is as important as building the best product. And so oftentimes storytelling and hiring and some of those key components, which are relatively soft skills, you know, tend to be just as important, if not more important sometimes than just building a superior product. You know, what we've seen in our data across our portfolio is this ability to stay alive for long enough generally leads to kind of positive material outcomes. But, you know, to do that, how do you stay alive long enough in market? You have to be able to fundraise. You have to be able to storytell. You know, you might just, if you build a superior product at the wrong time, you know, I love to say if you're building the right product at the wrong time, you're still wrong, right? And so you have to be able to kind of stay alive for long enough to see that market materialize around you, which means these soft skills, you know, become important.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard Andreessen, you know, Mark Andreessen make the comment around like distribution over products. You know, because if you get distribution, you know, eventually, even if your product isn't superior, and you're able to grow it, you're able to raise the capital, then you build the team in order to build the product, then you, you know, but if you have an amazing product and no one's using it or no one knows about it. So something we've thought about quite a bit. But while we're on the topic of kind of tech and all the rage is AI, you can't not have a podcast like this and not bring up the question of AI. I've heard you say how AI will amplify but not replace intelligence. Could you talk more about this idea and how startup founders should be thinking about AI in their businesses?
Yeah, it's fascinating that, you know, AI is clearly kind of the zeitgeist today, but AI has also been around for 50, 60 years. And so one of the early debates at MIT was between these two gentlemen, Marvin Minsky and JCR Licklider. And the debate was kind of around AI or IA. Was it artificial intelligence or was it intelligence amplification? And I think personally, I love to flip the letters around and talk more about IA because that's kind of what I think is really going on. You know, we tend to see kind of there's core infrastructure AI that's starting to happen that's kind of broad-based but very thin. And I think where we're more interested in AI is in specific task optimization. So if you take any job, what we think of as a job is actually a series of 100 tasks, right? And if you look at all those tasks, some of them are repeatable and rote and routine tasks that you do over and over again. So if you're doing those things in Excel, you would build a formula to replicate and do them over and over again, which is a basic form of programming. You know, and a more advanced form of programming might be to do some form of machine learning or AI. And so there are certain tasks that are repetitive that you're going to start to optimize away. And so we really look at the evolution of vertical SaaS as the kind of where we're looking for AI. Or IA. So we're looking really for specific workflows. And then within those specific workflows, you know, across the 100 tasks that somebody might do, if 20 of them are highly repeatable and automatable, let's take a lawyer, for example. If you're doing a redaction of documents or you're doing something like e-discovery, looking for proper nouns across 100,000 emails, of course, you could hire some associates to do that. You probably would be much better served to leverage some form of AI that amplifies the skills of your team where they can then focus on more human related skills. So that when we talk about kind of AI, I tend to put it in this category of you can make two choices, strong versus skinny. And you can either, let's say your output is a certain amount, you could either cut the inputs by 10 if AI is going to amplify those inputs to have the same output, right? That's kind of the skinny choice. So you could cut costs and you could cut team and have the same output, or you could multiply your team and multiply your output by 10. And so that's the strong choice. And I think more companies are going to opt for strong, where they're really going to kind of leverage vertical SaaS. They're going to leverage these intelligence amplification tools that make their workers 10 times more productive. Everyone tends to look at the negative and says, well, are we going to do away with all customer service agents because we can go to AI? We tend to think, yes, maybe there'll be some dislocations and there'll be some changes in that for sure. But really what will happen is customer service agents will probably be amplified to be 10 times more efficient and more effective, where they can focus on the corner cases and most of the rote and routine tasks that are highly repetitive will go to a bot or they'll go to AI.
Is there a risk that by going skinny, you require less venture capital, therefore the category of venture capital shrinks?
Yeah, I think there's a real chance. You know, we've seen with WhatsApp and we've seen with Instagram a few examples kind of through history of a 10 to 20 person team that creates a multi-billion dollar outcome. I do think we're going to start to see what I've kind of started calling thin companies. And thin companies are these ideas that you could have two or three or four people leveraging a suite of AI tools that are actually able to scale a company well beyond what they maybe could have in the past. And so the capital requirements of some of those companies from a human standpoint might go down. But you know, these running large language models and server costs and all these things, I mean, there are still crazy embedded technology costs associated with running these things. So I don't know that venture capital will shrink, but I do think opportunities around maybe being on the core team that could have been a 200-person startup, maybe now could be a 20-person startup. I think there, with that, you know, there could be interesting new changes to wealth creation under AI, where you know some people that are at the helm of some of these companies could have rather small headcounts with rather large market caps.
Two more questions here. You've invested in 300 companies now, right? So or more, maybe, yeah. I don't know, 300 plus across,
300 plus.
Across the world. Is there specific advice that you find yourself giving most often or anything that reflects the current environment? What do you kind of come back to that's something that you hear yourself saying time and time again?
Well, absolutely. Well, I've recently tried to write down the things that I say over and over again and crystallize them into a piece where I can sort of send out a link to somebody. So, you know, please, you know, check out my blog, on my website or on Everywhere Ventures website. We think about these things and we say them over and over again. So we try to put them into packaged formats where they're easier to digest. But the thing that I've been saying the most recently, well, a couple of things, one is make the hard choices early. And so the metaphor that I use is kind of, you've got preventative medicine, you've got the operating room, and you've got the emergency room. When you've got 6 months or less of runway, you're already in the emergency room and things start to get messy, right? It's the gloves come off and there's blood on the floor and you got to make hard decisions. Before that, the operating room is still messy, but you're in control, right? You can make hard decisions. You can cut costs. You can make tough decisions, but you're still in control. And so I think between, you know, 12 and 6 months are when you're in the operating room and you got to start making tough choices. And, so that's kind of one set of metaphors that I use and talk about a lot. And the other is, I think in the boom market of the last few years, we tended to think that money was unlimited. And so what people would say is, you know, I need to de-risk my business. So I need 18 months to do that. And it's going to cost me $100,000 a month of burn. And so therefore I need 1.8 million. So I'm going to go get 1.8 million. And so it was, burn was determining fundraise. What's happening now is, fundraisers are happening however they're happening. And so you might only be able to raise $1 million. And what people are saying is, well, okay, I raised a million. My burn's 100K. So I only have 10 months of runway. I'm like, no, time out. That's the wrong way to think about this. Your cash determines your budget, not your burn, right? So what you need to do is take the million, divide it by 18, probably divide it by 24, actually. And that is your new budget. So if you're taking a million divided by 24, your new burn rate, maximum net burn, is 50K a month. You might think you can only build the business doing 100K, but you need to figure out now how to do it on 50. And so this is the kind of Apollo 13 moment where, of course, you know, you want the perfect air filter and you want to be able to build the perfect product with all the perfect things. But what you actually have is some broken parts, some duct tape, and not the right things, but you've got to get home, right? So Apollo 13 was interesting where they needed to create an air filter or the pilots were going to die in the vehicle. And they only had a certain number of tools. They only had a certain number of things. They had duct tape. They had, nothing was perfect. And yet they managed to build this thing imperfectly to get themselves home. And I think that those are a couple of things that I say over and over is make those hard decisions in the operating room before you end up in the emergency room. And then take what cash you have and consider how to divide it to get the runway that you need and reset your budget. And that maybe means some hard choices. It maybe means some trade-offs and imperfect things, but that's the difference between staying alive and not. And so those are the kind of, when I'm on my soapbox saying the same thing over and over again, I feel like those are the two things I say probably five times a day.
Well, you've got a gift to storytell, and you know, and you know, I think it you know, if you look at the book, you know, the fuzzy and the techie, the liberal arts degree, you know, kind of rules the digital world. There's a lot of that description and kind of storytelling in the book, and you clearly have an ability to do that, starting from, you know, your friend that is looking at the map. So these are great visuals that I think are helpful for founders, because look at founders, there's a lot of advice out there and the things that resonate that people can remember. Now I'm going to go back and look at the thing and maybe share that Apollo 13 story with some of the founders I've invested in and even at Latitude, just to remember. I think it's a very good kind of picture that you painted. So look, how can people get a hold of you? What's the way to get in contact with you and Jenny if any founders are listening and they'd like to connect?
We're open for business. As I mentioned, we write, you know, 50 to 250K pre-seed checks. The best way to get in touch with us is our website, everywhere.vc, or through LinkedIn. LinkedIn is probably our primary sort of platform of choice. We don't use, you know, Twitter and TikTok as much as we do LinkedIn.
Right on. Cool. Well, thanks, Amanda. Thanks for the support. Thanks for also, you know, the partnership with Latitude. And we're really grateful to have you as, you know, part of our journey. And we're excited to continue to build together our area isn't everywhere. We're Latin America, but we're happy to have you guys as partners because the kind of cross fusion of networks is something that, you know, is really valuable for everybody. And so we're happy to be partners there.
Likewise, Brian. I'm excited for, you know, the future. Life is long, and got to get down to Mexico City and Sao Paulo together at some point.
Absolutely, man. No doubt about it. Well, thanks for your time, and we'll definitely be in touch.
Thank you for listening to Latitude Podcast. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast for more talks with great founders and investors. I'm your host, Brian Reckworth, Vamos Latam.